Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Pat Ward. I'm the administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings upon the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as the procedural hearing officer for this hearing. The record will show that it was a little past 8:30 a.m., October 22nd, 2012. We're at the Public Service Commission hearing room, 12-4 of the State Capitol Building, Bismarck, North Dakota. The time, date, and place set by the notice of hearing issued by the North Dakota Public Service Commission on August 1st, 2012. This is case number PU-12-59. We are here to hold a public hearing on the application of Northern States Power for an advanced determination of prudence of a power purchase agreement for 200 megawatts of wind energy from the Prairie Rose Wind Generation Project in Pipestone in Rock County, Minnesota, from Geronimo Wind, LLC, as set forth in the notice of filing and notice of hearing, which has all been duly noticed and published in accordance with the requirements of statute and the commission's rule. This is the public hearing on the application of Northern States Power, which is except for trade secret portions being broadcast on the web. The hearing is also being recorded. The notice of filing and notice of hearing for this hearing specified the following issue to be considered and determined upon this hearing: whether the resource addition is prudent. It appears that Commission staff disputes this prudence of the power purchase agreement. Before we begin, are there any opening comments from the commissioners? Commission Chairman Brian Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you, everyone, for being out here early on a Monday morning, getting right to it. Got a good turnout. I guess the only question I would have, Your Honor, is the as we get into the trade secret information, I mean, does folks think we'll get into that, or that's not really going to come out? And if we do, make sure we stop and start the tape at the appropriate time.
Mr. Chairman, we have discussed that in the pre-hearing conference, and the plan would be to, if it doesn't appear that there's going to be much of the trade secret information that will need to come in the public hearing. However, if for some reason we do get into that, the attorneys have advised me that they will caution us, and then we can stop the broadcast and go, you know, into a private discussion of those topics, and then we would be making a separate tape that includes that. And then at the conclusion of the private, non-public information, we would reopen the hearing and reopen the broadcast.
Sounds good. Just want to talk about this. Thanks again, everyone, for being here. Look forward to a good thorough hearing. Thank you.
Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thanks, everyone, for being here and for the hard work that's been done to this point. I do have a few items of direction. First of all, I would assume, counsel, that we're going to accept or stipulate all the pre-file testimony. No need to – okay, we can simply go to perhaps some review and then we can go right to it without having to read into the record everything that's been filed. I appreciate that. Also, you know – I think it's important just for a little historical perspective. Generally speaking, when we have an advanced determination of prudence, we will say, or some commissioner or perhaps the judge will say up front, that a finding that doesn't support advanced prudence means doesn't necessarily mean that we find it to be imprudent. I don't know that we could say that in this particular case, because the fact is advanced is because, of course, we don't have a rate case in front of us yet, but we do have the wind farm in front of us. And of course, we also want to acknowledge, in fairness to the company, that the reason for the application, or at least if, among perhaps other reasons, is that we required it in a previous rate case, and so we appreciate that you've honored that order, that part of the order. But it's also, I think, in fairness, I need to let you all know, I know you know this, but I think it's worth stating up front for the record that, of course, I've dissented on a previous case, not with this utility, but another utility that has very similar characteristics, and that is to say a wind farm built at the demand of another state's policies. So I don't think that it'll surprise anybody that I'm skeptical of this type of an application or at least honoring the request. I think that it's been well vetted and well testified to in the pre-file testimony. I appreciate both the work of the utility and, of course, the advocates who I think have argued their points very nicely and thoroughly and in the in the pre-filed testimony. So with that, I just wanted to make those clarifying comments that I view this as a prudence case as much as an advanced determination of prudence case. Probably the first one since we've had the ADP law where I believe that we're at the end of this, I would expect it would be settled. I also would caution, and perhaps this will come up, I don't know. Well, let me not get to that. I was going to talk about other ways, but we'll just wait and see how this one turns out first. Thank you.
Mr. Fetch.
Good morning, everyone. This is the first of this type of case that I'm being able to be involved in, so I look forward to hearing from everyone this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. Ms. Brahma, would you please state your appearance for the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Commissioners, thank you for having us today. My name is Liz Brahma. I'm an attorney with Grayson Morgan here representing Northern States Power Company. With me is Zev Simpson, also from my office.
And Mr. Grumman, would you state your appearance for the record, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mark Grumman, advocacy staff, counsel. To my left is Chris Merle, advocacy staff, and to his left is Richard Hahn from the Capra Associates. I'm testifying on behalf of advocacy.
Now, it's my understanding that counsel have met and agreed upon exhibits. And as I've indicated already, some of these exhibits contain trade secret information, which it may be necessary for us to close portions of the hearing if such information comes up. We had talked about providing the commissioners all of the stipulated exhibits at the beginning of the hearing, and then counsel can just reference them. Foundation has already agreed to. The exhibits have already been admitted. So if you would want to provide those to the commissioners now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's my understanding, Commissioners, that there's 10 exhibits. There are both public and private copies of each of the 10 exhibits.
Okay.
Are they going to collect, Your Honor, back up the non-public versions, or then we just...
I would say that the non-public versions, we can discuss that later during one of the breaks as to how we want to handle those.
But. Sure.
Now, before we proceed with opening statements, I did want to find out whether anyone is present in the room who may want to be heard on this issue other than counsel for the parties or witnesses or employees of the parties. Is there anyone in the room who might have a position to take on this application? Doesn't appear that there is. So as soon as Mr. Grumman is settled back in his chair, we can proceed with brief opening statements from counsel. Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Judge Ward. Commissioners, the company is here today, as Judge Ward indicated, to establish the prudence of the company's decision to enter into a power purchase agreement, or PPA, for 200 megawatts of wind generated by Prairie Rose Wind. Our presentation today will start with our witness, Laura McCartan, who will present the company's policy reasons for entering into the Prairie Rose PPA. Next, Director of Resource Planning, Kurt Hager, will discuss why the project is prudent from a resource planning standpoint. Steve Wishart will provide support for the results of our modeling efforts. And finally, Randy Oy will discuss transmission issues, and Carrie Clark will address management of the company's renewable energy credit, or REC, portfolio. I note for the exhibits that you have in front of you, there are public and non-public versions of each exhibit with the exception of Mr. Wishart's rebuttal testimony. There's only a public version of that testimony. The company believes strongly that the Prairie Rose project is a prudent purchase of a renewable resource and that the company's North Dakota customers will benefit from the company's ability to enhance its portfolio of cost-effective wind energy. We're happy to answer any questions the commission may have and to get the proceeding underway.
Mr. Grumman, would you care to make an opening statement?
Just briefly, Your Honor. As indicated before, advocacy staff has two witnesses, Chris Merle and Richard Hahn. You have read our pre-filed testimony, so I'll just defer to that. Do you understand our position in that regard? And we're looking forward to a very good hearing today.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Brahma, you may call your first witness.
For the company, we'd like to have Ms. Laura McCartan.
Carton, is your mic on?
You tell me.
Okay. Yep.
Okay, great.
All right. Before you begin your testimony, I'm required by law to advise you of the law regarding perjury in this state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $5,000, or both may be imposed. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. McCartan.
Good morning.
Would you mind just stating and spelling your full name and position for the record?
My name is Laura McCartan. That's L-A-U-R-A. M-C, capital C-A-R-T-E-N, and I'm Regional Vice President for Northern States Power.
Thank you. Do you have there with you Exhibits 1 public and Exhibit 1 non-public?
I do.
And are these your pre-filed direct testimony in this proceeding? I'm sorry, excuse me. These are Exhibit 2 public and Exhibit 2 non-public.
Correct. That's how they're labeled.
Yes. And these are your pre-filed testimony in this proceeding?
Yes.
I understand you've prepared an opening statement. Would you like to deliver that now?
Yes, thank you. Again, I'm Laura McCartan, Regional Vice President for Northern States Power, and I'm responsible for the regulatory, legislative, and community relations activities in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota. I started with the company as a nuclear engineer and have served in various capacities at the company for over 30 years. My direct testimony focused on the reasonableness of the Prairie Rose Power Purchase Agreement, or PPA, within the context of its low and stable energy costs and its contribution to our diverse energy portfolio for the integrated system that serves all of our customers in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. In 2010, the company began to observe increasingly competitive wind pricing in the Midwest. In our 2010 Midwest resource plan, we indicated our intention to issue a request for proposal for wind projects. Our goal was to determine whether wind generation was priced sufficiently low to warrant adding inexpensive renewable energy to our system. This competitive bid process, which garnered over 140 proposals, resulted in the selection of the Prairie Rose Wind Project, the power purchase. Prairie Rose offered the lowest legitimate wind pricing that we had ever seen in this region. Using the updated assumptions, including in Mr. Hager's testimony, or his rebuttal testimony, the Prairie Rose Wind Project will result in monthly savings for North Dakota customers as compared to the most competitive alternative. Even using the most conservative estimates, on average, a North Dakota residential customer would pay about 1.5 cents per month more for the Prairie Rose Wind Purchase Project over the 20-year lifetime of the project, as compared to the most competitive alternative. My direct testimony also addressed the nature of our integrated system, which has produced significant benefits for our North Dakota customers, and I'd like to briefly review the aspects of that. First, our five-state system means that we can achieve significant cost savings related to economies of scale. That is, we can invest in larger and more efficient power plants of varying fuel types than would be possible if we were a smaller standalone operation in North Dakota. And a good example of that is our nuclear power plants. We would not be able to provide such power to our North Dakota customers if it was a standalone system. Second, our system allows us to develop a more diverse energy supply portfolio than we would be able to on a state-by-state basis. This diversity protects against fuel price volatility, fuel supply constraints, and the impacts of power plant outages. Third, our integrated system provides good load diversity, such that the overall system load factor for our system is around 60%, which is much higher than is typical for smaller systems. What this means is that less customer load is exposed to on-peak market prices, which can be double or triple the cost of off-peak market prices. Fourth, our larger integrated system gives us the ability to issue requests for proposals for new resources sized at 150 megawatts or larger. RFPs of this magnitude are sufficient to draw the attention of large developers who are able to both bring large projects online in a timely manner and assume the numerous risks present in power plant development. Finally, there are advantages to size in attracting and developing top expertise in energy trading and risk management, as well as other critical utility functions such as engineering and operations. While the states we serve have established different renewable energy goals, we strive to seek a balance such that we are able to comply with the requirements of every state in a reasonable, cost-effective manner, so that the savings derived from the integrated system will benefit all of our customers and not be overshadowed. The Prairie Rose PPA is one of our lowest-cost wind projects and is consistent with this overarching objective and also does help us meet renewable energy goals. The driving force behind the Prairie Rose project is its benefits for the customers of each state in our system, and my testimony supports the policy reasons why this power purchase agreement is prudent. The witnesses that follow me will discuss this project in greater detail. That concludes my opening statement, and thank you.
Thank you. This witness is available for questions.
Mr. Grumman.
Well, I'll defer to opposing counsel because perhaps this may be a question better left to another witness, but in particular, if this ADP were approved, could you please explain to us and the commission about how those costs would be recovered by the company?
Mr. Grumman, it's my understanding that as a power purchase agreement, the cost would be recovered through the fuel clause on a proportional basis relative to the North Dakota customer load compared to our total system load.
That's about, what, 5.8%?
Subject to somebody knowing the exact number, that sounds in the ballpark.
Anything else? I have no further questions.
Any follow-up?
No, Your Honor.
Any questions from the commissioners for Ms. McCartney?
Wonderful. Where's our attorney go to? Jerry, go see where our attorney's at, please.
For the record, we're taking a brief pause while we look for Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, who stepped out of the room briefly. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Yes. I went to get some trade secret forms to sign for the end for the trade secret exhibits, and I wondered if there was another copy of the exhibits. Commission advocacy staff, or I mean commission advisory staff, did not get a copy.
Certainly, we can provide an additional copy.
Okay.
Thanks. Did you want my appearance and?
Yes, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco. You might as well.
Sorry,
Alana. Looking for that. Note your appearance for the record.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, Commission Advisory Staff. With me is Patrick Fawn and Jerry Lean, also as Advisory Staff. And I will have those forms for folks to sign in a minute for the trade secret exhibits.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, when you briefly stepped out of the room, we've concluded Ms. McCartan's testimony. I'm not sure if you heard it all.
I have no questions for Ms. McCartan. Thank you.
All right.
I will pass these forms out, though, if everyone who has a copy of a confidential exhibit would please sign a form, return them to me. Appreciate it. Not the company, but the others.
Perhaps while these forms are going around, if I could just clarify one item for the record purposes.
Please do.
Counsel for advocacy staff and I and Judge Ward did confirm earlier, as Commissioner Kramer indicated, that we have stipulated to the admission of all exhibits. This includes Exhibit 1, public and non-public, which is our application in this matter. I misspoke earlier when I asked Ms. McCartan about Exhibit 2, which is her testimony. So Exhibit 1 has been pre-admitted. We'll refer to it as needed during the hearing.
I think we can take care of the formality of the forms here as we go. Get a little break as we go ahead. Commissioner Koch, any questions for Ms. McCartan?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Laura, for your testimony. I know we have a lot of witnesses coming, so I'm not going to go too far down into weeds off the bat. But just from you're one of the senior members of the company, and just kind of give me your thoughts about as the company looks back and figures out, you know, what percentage of wind you want to have, what percentage of nuclear you want to have, what percentage of coal, what percentage of hydro. You talked about the IRP and just how, as a planning perspective, how you look at it from your level.
Okay, Commissioner Koch, thank you. We look at it on an evolving level, so we're always looking at what do we know today, what do we think is happening in the future, because every decision that we make today we know stays with us for many years. So we try to, on an always going forward basis, we're making decisions just about every year on how best to meet our customers' needs, how best to serve the integrated system. We do integrated resource planning so that we can take long views and try to make sure that decisions that we take year by year are always guided by a good long view of factors that should influence our decision, factors that can relate to cost of energy, supply of energy, things of that sort. I think a big factor that guides us is the value of the diversity of our energy portfolio, the idea of not having all of our eggs in one basket, and I often liken that to the diversity of a 401k or a financial portfolio, because none of us can predict the future exactly. It's wise and it's prudent to have diversity in our supply portfolio. So that's, I think, a big aspect of how we try to plan going forward. I think we're in a position that would be the envy of a lot of utilities with the diversity that we have. About 30% of our energy comes from our nuclear power plants, Monticello and Prairie Island, where I think about 40% of our energy right now comes from coal-fueled power plants. We're at something, I don't know the exact numbers, but we're somewhere around maybe 13% of renewable. That's almost entirely wind energy. We have growing amounts of natural gas fuel generation as part of our portfolio. And every day, and also over the long term, we're also accessing the market to make sure that we're getting, you know, low-cost energy resources wherever we can. So overall, I would say that our approach is always sort of constantly evolving, looking at the best information available, trying to look with a long view, and always trying to manage risks so that we can provide reliable, low-cost energy to our customers now, for today, and into the future.
Okay. So tell me how you integrate you serve a variety of states. If North Dakota has a goal for so much renewable, which is the goal, or Minnesota would have a mandate of a certain amount, how do you integrate that into your planning? Because it seemed to me that would drive some of the planning.
Well, and I probably defer most of this to Kurt Hager, who is our resource planning expert, leads that group for the company. But I do believe that as we stand here today, we've been able to add the wind resources that are part of our integrated system in this upper Midwest integrated system. I think we can show with facts that every time we've chosen that wind resource, it's always been cost competitive with what would be an alternative at that time. So where we are today, I think our portfolio has been a low, at least cost.
So in your opinion, you always use cost as the factor that determines your resource. I think that's what I just heard. But even though it may be a mandate from a state, you still look at the cost of it.
I was going to go on to say that I was using the term least cost, and I'm not sure I'm using that term correctly because I think we look at other factors as well. Okay. But I think that the portfolio that we deliver to our customers is very cost effective and cost competitive.
Okay,
going
you.
Forward, I think that's something that, you know, we'll see how that plays out going forward.
And then just the last thing I'd have just for you is we've had a lot of discussion recently in the commission about how a company views an IRP. They file an IRP with the commission, and in the past, the commission has not necessarily responded back to IRPs because we wanted to wait, save that opportunity to comment in the future. But so did I hear in your testimony, you said you gave us the IRP, and And that was almost like a, we told you we were going to do this back when, and now we're doing it, where you valued, you had a lot of weight in the IRP that you filed as to your future resource plans?
Well, as I understand our IRP, we lay out what we think is a, at a high level, the a prudent course of action to serve our customers' needs over the long haul. But then year by year, with every specific decision that we make, we're always testing the particulars of that decision. Does this make sense? And sometimes it may fit within the larger view that's set by the IRP, and sometimes it may not. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Well, and this is maybe outside this particular case, but so when you file an IRP, if you don't hear something back from the North Dakota Public Service Commission, do you take that as they agree with my IRP, or do you just take it as they have no position at this time on it?
Commissioner, I don't think that we take it as that you agree. I mean, if the commission hasn't specifically acted, we don't presume the commission's position.
All right, thank you. That was actually all I had. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Kramer.
Yes, thank you, Laura. You referred a few times to this project as being the low-cost wind project. Is that to say it's not the low-cost energy project? Just so I'm clear.
Commissioner, in my opening remarks, I did mention that using updated assumptions that Mr. Hager used in the modeling of comparing adding the Prairie Rose Wind Project to the next least cost alternative, that adding the Prairie Rose Wind Project was less costly. Okay. So it would be a net savings to North Dakota customers.
Well, one of the struggles I have with all of this, and it's why we've decided as a commission to become a little more proactive in the IRP process for all of our utilities, multi-state utilities, of course, is that while you state the value of fuel diversity, load diversity, we're also seeing growing diversity among state policies, and that's the challenge, of course, that we have, or at least that I have. And so, as states start being very different in terms of their culture and their policies related to regulated utilities, I think we have to become all the more discerning as protectors of our own ratepayers. If it weren't for Minnesota's mandate of 30% by 2030, would you be building this wind farm?
Yes, we would, because it's a cost-effective resource, and it's part of how we do our business kind of every day, is looking for cost-effective resources that would displace more costly resources. So on a kind of a real-time basis, trying to bring the best cost energy resource to serve our customers.
So if it was 40% or 50%, I mean, or 10%, the mandate, this would still be, you'd still be building this 200 megawatts in Minnesota.
Commissioner, yes, because when we launched the RFP to test the market back in fall of 2010, because what we were seeing with such low wind prices, we at that time did not need to add new renewable wind sources to keep pace even with our Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard. We were several years away from having to do that. What we have done in the past and what has served our customers very well is we haven't waited till the last moment to serve a need and to go forward and meet a need. And I think we've seen that some utilities that have done that, particularly with wind, and some here in North Dakota, when they waited till the last moment, they bought in at the top of the market. Because we have, I think, take a prudent approach and not always waited till the last moment, in this case is a particular case, we tested the market, and because we found the prices so low that in and of itself, regardless of being wind or something else, in and of itself, that price was good for our customers.
So how hard have you looked for something other than this 200 megawatts of wind that might be lower cost? Because just now, your statement just now, you said particularly wind when referring to other utilities that have waited till the last minute. I mean, your statement, all statements seem to be predicated on the notion that you were looking for wind.
In particular for the Prairie Rose, that did result from a wind RFP in the fall of 2010 because of specifically the wind market. But the example I gave about not waiting to the last moment, I can say that that's exactly the same thing we did when we did the conversion of a couple of very old coal plants in Minnesota to natural gas. We got ahead of the curve on that, and we accomplished those projects at a much lower cost than people who are perhaps doing those projects today.
One thing about resource planning, to get back to something you in with regard to Commissioner Kalk's questioning as you go forward, I mean, isn't the sort of the tradition has been with regulated utilities that you sort of deal with what you know today, including costs, including need. And I think if I understand you're saying we want to be more proactive. We're looking out to the future to try to, I assume, mitigate risk, but of course that carries with it risk as well. It hasn't the tradition in regulated utilities and rate making been, you know, let's deal with what we know today as far as both demand and cost and policy?
Commissioner, that is a big part of what we do. But the other thing we do, and again, Mr. Hager can elaborate, is we test those assumptions and we try to come up with a course of action that we call it robust. In other words, a course of action that doesn't rely upon a very one narrow prediction of the future, but something that is a good choice even if demand, customer demand, grows more than you think it might or is less than you think it would be, or if gas prices are higher than you think they might be or lower or anything like that. So we try to use the best information available to us today. We also try to do sensitivity analyses so that we can test the robustness of our course of action and land on a course of action that we think is robust, given the uncertainties of the future.
One of the things that you stated in, as sort of evidence of the value of the diversity of your plant and the value to North Dakota customers and the value of an integrated plan was what we gain as North Dakota customers from the nuclear plants that you have. And yet, I mean, yet Minnesota has pretty well confined the growth of those plants, have they not, and required the growth of renewables, have they not? And so isn't your integrated resource plan that we benefit from supposedly really being driven by Minnesota largely?
Well, Commissioner, there's no doubt that Minnesota is the largest jurisdiction we serve. So it is an issue that we grapple with as a company. And I appreciate your early remarks that you as a commission representing your state are also grappling with the implications of differing state policies, and we grapple with that as well. So we try to really work with all of our stakeholders and commissions to try to get to the best answer. When it comes to nuclear, the state of Minnesota does have a moratorium on new nuclear plants, but the state of Minnesota also has approved life extension, 20 years of additional operation for both the nuclear plants. The power upgrade at Monticello, which will get more megawatts out of an existing power plant, is well on its way. The one at Prairie Island was approved by the commission, but that is under some review at this point that we actually initiated. So in one sense, yes, there is a moratorium. In the other sense, the state has supported and enabled continued and expanded use of the nuclear power plants in the state.
And, of course, North Dakota customers are confined to whatever Minnesota decides, good, bad, or otherwise, with regard to nuclear expansion and wind mandates, it would seem, as long as we're going to approve whatever they demand in terms of policies.
Well, Commissioner, again, I guess that's the conundrum. But if we come back to maybe the fundamentals of does it serve the customers well in North Dakota, and I think that our application shows that in the case of Prairie Rose it does, then I would hope that that still is the overriding sort of consideration.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your statement about, you know, you work with all the stakeholders and, you know, the conundrums, you know, try to deal with all that. And yet, you know, North Dakota being an energy-producing state, sixth largest exporter of electricity, we've had this discussion countless times, both informally and formally. And you're sitting here today, so we might as well have it again formally. XL really hasn't done it very well to the satisfaction of this commission and to the policymakers of this state, because you still haven't built anything in North Dakota despite all of the efforts and all of the promises, and I'll get to the one that you no doubt are anticipating, that you would. And I guess when I think of all of the investment that XL's made in generation, And North Dakota's never been a prudent place to make that investment, yet several others have found it to be. I mean, since I've been on the commission, 1,500 megawatts of new wind nameplate capacity been built in the state. Somebody deemed it prudent. Somebody thought it was a good investment. Some somebody someplace is using that electricity, and yet Xcel's never been able to find a way to do it in North Dakota. And I just struggle with the failure of that. And quite honestly, each time you come before us and ask us to deem something prudent somewhere else, and I look back on all of those discussions, all of those attempts, all of those promises, frankly, and I think, God, is it credible? You know what I mean? I wonder, is it credible that nothing can be built in North Dakota? And quite honestly, even these 200 megawatts, I guess, have you thought about asking Minnesota to pay for 100%? Aren't we? How do we know that they wouldn't be pleased as punch to pay for it because it meets their cultural mandates? And the transmission lines that were built out of there were built as a result of the very first mandate, which required the wind farm to be built in Minnesota in the first place. And I just sort of wonder if there's even a need for it. I mean, those are just sort of my out loud thoughts. And I'd be happy to hear your response to it. Maybe while I'm on, I'll bring up the May 7th, 2007, when Jack Dalrymple and Mayor Wallaker and I stood at your facility in Fargo, and Paul Bonavia, your president for the Energy Utilities Group, said you were going to build 200 megawatts in North Dakota within the next 5 years. And you didn't qualify it. At that time, we produced 668 megawatts of wind in North Dakota, and now we're over 1,500. None of it's Xcel's. Mayor Wallaker said, "I can't say enough about meeting their commitment. You can get all kinds of lip service in this world, but the commitment is what we ask for." I mean, what are we to make of that when we're sitting here one more time trying to determine whether or not it's prudent to build 200 megawatts in Minnesota that, frankly, doesn't even look like there's a need for, in all honesty. Maybe there will be in the future, except to meet a mandate. I'm struggling with it, so I need your help.
Commissioner, we have made efforts to build wind projects in North Dakota, and you're familiar with the Mericourt project that ultimately we exercised a withdrawal option on for a lot of good reasons, and ultimately when we think about the customers of North Dakota, all of our customers, we had all of the, it's a matter of legal, it's under litigation right now, so I'm being careful about the words that I choose, but we exercised the option that was available to us under the terms of the contract, and that also happened to be a very prudent step to take for our customers because of many reasons. We then made effort to try to find a substitute project here in North Dakota. It was coming towards the end of 2011, and that project ultimately found a better market for its turbines, so we were not able to execute that Border Winds project. Right now, as we see the production tax credit expiring at the end of this year and no clear path that's going to be renewed, there really are no cost-effective wind projects out there. And so from the standpoint of serving our customers best, we haven't met that commitment to North Dakota because the projects that we sincerely pursued, put a lot of effort into, ultimately are not good for our customers. This is something that's been a topic of a lot of discussion between us and the commission. I don't know what else I can say about that, but we are pursuing additional investigations into potential natural gas fueled plant that's very early. I can't tell you how that's going to play out, what the pros or cons are, but we have begun those investigations. We've been responding to staff to information requests that have come to us in the context of the last resource plan we filed, and we are going to evaluate that very sincerely as well. I'm not sure what else I can say to you about that.
Well, I guess I would be curious. What if the North Dakota legislature this winter said, you know what, doggone it, lignite's really important to North Dakota. We're going to pass a mandate that all utilities in North Dakota have to produce at least 80% of their electricity with lignite coal. It's low cost, it's abundant, it's clean. We have cleaner air than Minnesota has. Let's just do that. Would Minnesota's commission say, yeah, okay, it's a diverse portfolio, it's diverse, or it's a diverse company, it's diverse load. We'll just go ahead and approve prudence. Would they do that?
I can't speak to what the Minnesota Commission would do.
There's a good chance they wouldn't.
I just don't even want to speak on their behalf.
Well, so at any rate, as you can tell, I'm a skeptic. You probably knew that coming in.
Commissioner, you did, and previously you did ask a question, if I may follow up with you, about whether this project is needed. And I think the crux of our position is it's not a question of need, it's a question of opportunity. And the value and the low cost and the other positive aspects of the energy from this project stand on their own and are of value to our customers.
That's a little bit like going to the two-for-one sale, even though you don't need either one of the two you bought, but you save 50% getting two of them. I don't think that's how we plan, but at any rate, I understand. I appreciate your testimony, your candor, and your willingness to sit here and take both my questions and my statements. But I really, my patience is exhausted with regard to previous commitments and attempts to do something that so many other utilities have been able to do, and the biggest one isn't. You know, it seems to me that the biggest company with the biggest load and the biggest fleet ought to have the advantage in finding something good to do in North Dakota from an investment standpoint, and yet for some reason all that bigness works against us, and I struggle with it. And this is the only shot we get, is when you guys are in front of us for something, and I'm gonna use it as much as I can for the benefit of both our ratepayers and our economy.
I appreciate the exchange, Commissioner.
Thank you, Laura. I have nothing further.
Commissioner Fetch.
Well. Okay, following that, I guess I just wanted to ask you to flesh out a little bit more specifically in the, portfolio. You said you had about 30% nuclear, 40% coal-fueled power plants, and about 13% renewable energy, mostly of which was wind. What else is in that renewable energy? Hydro, I assume, and
Commissioner, I think there's some turkey litter. It's a sort of a biomass fuel, and there's a little tiny bit of solar, and probably a little bit of hydro as well, but small hydro is what would count and not the large hydro that we get from Manitoba Hydro, the 500 megawatts. And I will also say that I believe that Kurt Hager or Steve Wishart will, when they're testifying, they could give you the precise breakout. I'm kind of going by memory here.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Yes, you know, actually, a couple follow-up, if that's okay.
Chairman Cock.
Laura, just a couple follow-ups to what Commissioner Kramer talked about, because one thing I think that's always been a hallmark of the commission is we pretty much say what's on our mind and get right to it. So I appreciate Kevin putting the dialogue right out there to follow up on, because The one of the things that Commissioner Kramer talked about in his opening statements is we had a previous case in front of the commission that went 2-1. It was myself and Commissioner Clark went one way and Kevin went the other way. And his points then were the same as now, is that there was a resource to build, to meet the needs of another state. But one of the things that I struggled with during that case is that the company never came to us in front early enough, and they built it. But there was this used and useful term that maybe it wasn't – it was built for some other need, but there was some value that we got out of it. But I remember I ended up voting yes, give them some value on that. But had that been a different scenario, it would have played out differently, perhaps. And that's what we're in right now, is we're sitting in a case where there's a wind farm that you're talking about building, and this is our chance, just as Kevin laid out there, to say, listen, we don't think this is the best idea, because this is why we asked, I think, the commission for ADPs. But tell me this, just to make sure I'm clear on how this lays out. So if the commission gives you an advanced termination of prudence, you can build it and start flowing up to the fuel clause adjustment until the next rate case, or does that go in perpetuity then? Or does that just – I'm not sure.
Commissioner, I believe that with a power purchase agreement, it once it's in the fuel clause, it stays in the fuel clause and it's not subject to a future rate case.
Almost a little bit different than a wind rider, but kind of the same kind of accounting tool, perhaps. Maybe that's something later that we can talk about.
Perhaps the difference is between a power purchase agreement and a project that's owned by the company, but I think I would defer to my counsel. So if it was a project that we built and owned, then we would it would come through a rate proceeding.
Fair enough. And then if this commission doesn't grant an advanced termination of prudence, you can still build it and take all the cost. But then at that point, you would come back at some point in a rate case and probably try to recover those costs?
You're speaking hypothetically about a project that would be built? So
well, absolutely. Because if this commission doesn't grant an ADP, you can still enter into the agreement.
So, Commissioner, if the commission to make sure I understand the question, if the commission were to not grant the ADP on this power purchase agreement, I think what we'd then have to do is we'd have to work out, well, what does that mean to the fuel clause and what modifications or what provisions might need to be put in place in the fuel clause tariff to handle the fact that there's an energy resource that's not being recovered from the North Dakota fuel clause, because it's still out there. It's still part of the integrated system, so it's a complicated issue. I don't know all the particulars, and I think we'd need to work with staff and perhaps develop a record for that.
Absolutely. I just wanted to set some of the – I think our discussion with you, I think, sets a tone for a lot of the future testimony today. And then I guess one of the next things I was thinking about, as Commissioner Kramer was talking, is that, you know, you go back through your testimony, and, you know, this commission did grant an ADP for Maricourt back in August of 2009. So it's not like the commission won't grant ADPs for wind resources built in North Dakota that meet a certain need. But it almost seems like, you know, there's a commitment to build wind no matter what. Did you read through the testimony? And that's the part that I guess all needed to be swayed as this thing goes forward, that all the other resources were looked at. And so that's just kind of, I guess, just a setup. But it's an interesting scenario that has developed over the last few years with North Dakota, with building generation here, particularly wind, and how we look at the cost as it lays out to North Dakota consumers. So I guess that would be the only thing I would close up with, so thank you.
Mr. Kramer.
Well, I just want to clarify a couple of things. First of all, if it's built in North Dakota, it's presumed prudent. You understand that we have that presumption, that you have that. That is a tool
to
utilize. Right. Secondly, we are talking about purchased power here. You're not building this wind farm. It's there, and then you're going to, okay, I have nothing for you.
Anything else from the commissioners before I'm going to go around through the attorneys one more time at least? And Ms. Brahma, do you have any follow-up to any of the things the commission asked or the council for this PSC asked?
Not at this time, Your Honor. I think Mr. Hager is maybe in a good position to address some of these issues further when he's on the stand, and so I think we'll wait until he's available to maybe answer some of the questions the commissioners have raised.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Grumman.
Obviously, staff is the same opinion. I think we have follow-up questions, but I think they're probably best to be submitted to Mr. Hager, so we'll defer.
Ms. Jeffco Tackle.
I do have one based on the questions from the commissioners. Is there a fixed payment component in the purchase agreement that might come up in a future rate case, or is it all variable payment?
Ms. Jeffco Tackle, I believe this is all costs that would come through the fuel clause and none through a rate base or rate proceeding.
Thanks.
Hey, anything further from the commissioners? Ms. McCartan, I think you can step down.
Thank you.
Started out hot this morning.
Oh, it'll get easier now.
The company calls Mr. Kurt Hager.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Hager, before we begin, I'm required by law to advise you the law regarding perjury in this state. As I indicated, perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $5,000, or both may be imposed. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. You may proceed, Ms. Brown.
Good morning, Mr. Hager. Could you perhaps state and spell your name for the record as well as your title?
Curtis J. Hager, K-U-R-T-I-S, middle initial J. Hager, H-A-E-G-E-R. I'm managing director of resource planning for Xcel Energy.
And do you have with you there exhibits 3 public and exhibit 3 non-public?
I do.
And are those correct copies of the direct testimony you submitted in this proceeding?
They are.
And you also have exhibits 4 public and 4 non-public?
I do.
And is that your rebuttal testimony from this proceeding?
It is.
All right. Thank you very much. I understand you have an opening statement. Please go ahead and provide it.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
I'm Managing Director of Resource Planning for Xcel Energy. My responsibilities include overseeing the direction, development, and implementation of the electric resource plan for all of Xcel Energy's utility operating companies, and this includes the North Dakota plan. I provided both direct and rebuttal testimony in this case. In my direct testimony, I elaborated on the company's several efforts to secure wind generation from the North Dakota facility. I also explained how Prairie Rose came to be selected as a particularly advantageous wind project for our customers in a wind market offering historically low prices. And at the time the PPA was executed, and even here today, we do not know whether we will be able to obtain wind energy at the price in the future, given the expected expiration of the federal production tax credits at the end of 2012. There has recently been a question whether we need 200 megawatts of Prairie Rose wind on our system. To answer this question, one must understand there are two primary drivers in developing an effective resource plan. The first component is the capacity component, or as I like to refer it, iron in the ground to meet that peak day need. The second component is energy and the fuel acquisitions to generate that energy. When looking at a wind project like Prairie Rose, the energy produced by the project competes to satisfy the minute-by-minute energy needs of our customers. Similar to buying energy from the MISO market, or burning gas in a gas plant, or burning coal in one of our coal plants. With the normal dispatch function of the company, and or now MISO, since they actually dispatch the system, on any day, any hour, or any minute, there are a number of options available to meet the customer's energy needs. And as a result, it is not a question of whether we need the energy, but rather of which source of energy is the most economical to consume for that specific period of time. So the more appropriate question that should be answered is whether we pay another generator in the market to produce energy on our behalf through MISO, or a gas producer to drill more wells, or a coal mine to open additional coal mining areas, or a wind producer to put in more turbines to produce more wind energy. The goal of the energy component of the resource plan is to provide the means to generate the most effective form of energy. In my direct testimony, I noted that wind generation is a cost-effective energy resource and enables the company to quickly add to the diversity of our energy portfolio. In fact, at the time we executed the Prairie Rose purchase agreement, this wind source allowed us to immediately displace more expensive alternative forms of energy. I also explained how the modeling of the Prairie Rose project shows that the project was reasonable and a prudent energy decision, even under highly conservative modeling assumptions. Wind energy provides immediate energy benefits to the system, just like this past year across country when utilities purchased additional natural gas in lieu of burning coal, where they actually displaced coal usage with lower-priced natural gas due to the depressed prices of natural gas. It wasn't a question of whether the country needed additional gas-fired energy. It was a question of whether it made economic sense to burn more gas in lieu of coal to produce the finite amount of energy that the country actually needed. In my rebuttal testimony, I responded to several issues raised by Mr. Hahn on behalf of the Commission staff. First, I noted that the prudence of a particular utility investment is traditionally determined on the basis of the facts and the circumstances known at the time of the utility's decision to proceed with the investment. While we agree that the Commission may desire updated information, and we've provided that updated information in my testimony, the company cannot make prudent energy investment decisions on basis of facts it cannot possibly know at the time the decision was made. Finally, I reiterated in my rebuttal why the Prairie Rose PPA is a reasonable and prudent decision on behalf of all of our customers. Modeling the likely costs and benefits of various energy options, including wind and gas, and the operation of our coal fleet, involves art as well as science and depends heavily on the assumptions one considers. Our initial analysis was very conservative but reasonable, utilizing less conservative but still reasonable assumptions as of the time our Prairie Rose PPA was executed, as well as incorporating the value of the renewable energy credits in light of Mr. Hahn's direct testimony. Our economic analysis shows an updated range of possible savings somewhere around $0.2 million for the wind energy to up to $18.6 million of energy value. We believe this project makes sense for our customers and as a prudent source of energy. And this concludes my opening statement.
At this time, the witness is available for questions. I'd like to encourage commissioners to ask maybe some of the same questions of Mr. Hager that you asked of Ms. McCartan. He may have additional information. Same for Council for Advocacy staff. I understand the question you asked, you may like to ask Mr. Hager as well.
We're good.
Thank you, Mr. Grumman.
Thank you. Well, maybe let's just cut right to it. The biggest issue of contention between, it seems to me, advocacy staff and the company is this whole issue is when, what price of gas we should be used. Is that correct? And that's kind of your understanding, January 2011 or January 31st, 2012. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you can understand why that's so important to us, because we're talking a 25% differentiation in gas prices. Is that correct?
I don't know the exact number, but I assume it's probably in that range.
Really close. And from a dollar standpoint, that would, we're probably talking about probably the $40 or $50 million as far as a net present revenue requirement standpoint. Is that correct?
I think it's in that range. I'd have to see the numbers specifically, but I think it's in that range.
Okay. Let's talk about the PPA. Was the PPA contingent upon North Dakota Public Service Commission approval?
I do not believe it was.
Now, when the PPA was approved, was there an application submitted to this commission for ADP?
No, it was not submitted at the exact same time. It was submitted approximately a year later.
So why a year later?
I think, actually, Ms. McCartan might have been a little bit better witness to answer that question. But I think it was an issue of our understanding of bringing something to the commission that is known for sure, and that when you have the ability to have it in front of you, that it's not something that is still in question and you will have the ability to act upon it with more certainty. Now, I think there is a question, and I think it's a fair question, of when should you see an application come to you relative to when, let's say, Minnesota would see it?
Well, I mean, I represent ratepayers, and we're looking at, we wouldn't even be having this discussion if you would have filed your app for the ADP at the time that you submitted the time that you reached an agreement on the PPA, because of the fact that we're looking at a $50 million differentiation. I mean, you can understand our apprehension in that regard, can't you?
Yeah, I think you also have to look at it from the standpoint when we agreed to the PPA, which was in approximately March, we were using the information that we knew in January. So even there, there's some staleness, just because once you enter into a process in resource planning, you have to set a stake in the ground so both the developer and the company have some assurances what they're negotiating on stays constant for a period of time. And certainly, even in Minnesota, the filing didn't come till, you know, months later. And even in that time, prices had changed, even under that circumstance. And so you always have a fundamental shift in, or you always have the potential for gas prices moving around. And again, I think the question is, when we're looking at the agreement and when we're negotiating the agreement, is when it's appropriate to tie down those prices. Certainly, regulatory proceedings, RFP proceedings take months. Typically, an RFP might take 9 to 18 months for us to get through. So we obviously, many cases, have to deal with stale information. And it's very difficult to suggest that you can continue to update all the way along that process. It just doesn't make sense. Otherwise, you would never get a chance to actually have a final decision on anything.
Mr. Kramer indicated, of course, this is advanced prudence because it's we don't have a rate case, that it's whether or not that this project is prudent. The thing about it, one thing in particular, you talked about change. How did they change? I mean, where were the gas prices headed in that direction at that time when you're talking about how gas prices were always changing?
You know, the last couple years in the gas business have actually been quite unnatural, let's say. When you look back at prices in 2008 when gas was trading at $12 a decatherm, nobody anticipated that 3 years later they would be trading at $4 a decatherm. And so to suggest that I could predict exactly the direction of where everything, all gas prices are going to go in the future, is, I don't think I want to take that bet. And so although they were trending down due to the shale development, the question is how low would they go? And so I don't think you can necessarily say that that trend would always continue. I think there was a lot of question exactly where gas prices would end up based upon how big the shale plays actually came out to be in the United States.
In all probability, it was likely that gas prices were going to continue to be decreasing at the time that you struck the PPA. Wouldn't that be correct?
I think when you look back at the NYMEX and kind of the averages, you'll see that, which is the New York Mercantile Exchange for natural gas contracts, which is the most widely traded gas contract, they've been in that 390 to 450 range. 2012 is an aberration. I think if you look even today, they're back up into that $3.50, $4 range. And so when you look at exactly what happened in 2012, we actually had a large storage overhang. We went into a period where we didn't have a winter. And so when you go into a winter season with a large storage overhang and very little consumption, which was happened in the winter of 2012, you'll get very depressed prices. That doesn't suggest on the long term that those prices will continue to stay depressed. It was in the short term. And so I think you also have to take into account what's happening in the natural gas markets. I mean, certainly gas prices since January of 2012 have rebounded to today. I believe they're trading in the $3.50 to $3.80 right now, certainly not around the $2 or $2.50 range that we saw back then. So I think you have to take into context of what's going on in that broader market.
Well, maybe just for the benefit of some of the public that are probably listening as well, and you just heard some significant discussion about gas prices, and I'm going to ask this question just to show just how pervasive this question is as far as how gas is really affects everything. Explain to me wind integration costs and how gas is tied to wind integration costs.
The cost of wind integration, which is actually the idea that a gas unit has to be available to ramp up and down to follow the wind, means that you actually have more generation running to be able to help ramp than you would normally have had without that wind there. And that's the integration cost. And since those units are traditionally gas-type units, the cost that is generated to have those units available and spinning is a gas cost. And therefore, as the gas prices change, those integration costs change.
So even though that you're modeling wind, you're really modeling gas as a variable of wind as well to adequately model it. Would that be correct?
Again, when we model wind as an energy resource, we are automatically modding coal, gas, and market energy. We're not just modeling the impacts of wind. We're modeling the impacts of wind energy against those other forms of energy. So by its general nature, we will always model the impacts of gas when we're looking at wind because they compete against each other. It's basically a fuel contract. I either buy wind fuel or I buy natural gas fuel. And so when I look at that, I certainly look at natural gas prices because that's what it's competing against.
From a PVRR standpoint, when you modeled this project or this PPA in comparison to other projects, how more expensive or cheaper did you determine? If you could please reiterate that for us today.
Again, in our initial modeling and my direct testimony, we said it was slightly more expensive. And under the assumptions, again, I say modeling is an art from the standpoint of what assumptions you include. In the original modeling of it, we included wind integration at a 25% penetration level as opposed to what this project would bring us to, which is about 13%. So we used the updated modeling, moved the wind integration to the more appropriate wind integration level. But when we looked at that, it was slightly more expensive in our original case. Based upon the direct testimony of Mr. Hahn, we went back and clarified and made more specific to some of his issues exactly what the costs were. When we look at that updated modeling, this project shows to be cost-effective in the most conservative case by still $0.2 million. And in the expected case, it's probably closer in almost to $19 million of savings.
Here's my apprehension about that. Before, you indicated slight. And also, you've testified that the change in gas ended up being, from our pharmacy, I think it's essentially fact, $40 or $50 million. So, and we're here for prudency. So wouldn't it have been more prudent that you modeled this PPA and it's just slightly more expensive or cheaper? Wouldn't you want something a lot more robust, considering that in the market you're looking at such a wide dynamic in gas prices?
Again, when you look at wind energy as a displacement for gas, and you realize that when we look out in the future in our resource plans, today almost all the additions are going to be natural gas additions. I mean, when you look out for the near-term future, we don't see, unfortunately, unless lignite comes in, we don't see much opportunity for many other resources out there other than natural gas-type resources. So we anticipate that we'll be adding a lot of natural gas resources in the future. And so when you look at this mix, and there is a lot of variability, having a portion of your portfolio, as you were talking about with Laura McCartan, a portion of your portfolio not exposed to natural gas prices makes sense. And so that's what wind helps, because it's just a trade-off. And I think we've been able to actually walk a fine line here where we have been able to select, due to the PTCs, economic wind and bring it on our system as a part of our portfolio. And certainly, we only can do that at the information that we know at the time. Because I don't even know next year exactly what gas prices are going to do. Certainly, if you go back to the 2006-2007, nobody anticipated gas prices would go to $12 a decatherm. But they do. They're variable. So I don't get caught up in this idea of if there's a little increase or a little drop, is that going to change? The fundamentals in the United States suggest that gas prices are going to be in the $4 to $7 range going forward, depending upon what source. And I think that's the long-term view that you have to fit within. And is it economic in that view? And I think it is.
Speaking of long-term view, I mean, as Commissioner Kramer indicated, at some point 30% of your generation is going to have to be renewable. I mean, how does that factor into your decision here as far as your RFP looking just for wind? Was it just gas, fuel diversity, or, I mean, clearly that was part of your analysis, wasn't it?
Certainly, we're trying to bring together two different hemispheres. One is the economic hemisphere that North Dakota wants to make sure that it keeps for its customers. And the second is the renewable standard for Minnesota. And I think with this project, we were actually able to bring them together in one project. It was economic for all customers, and it would also suffice to fill part of the renewable energy standard for Minnesota. So in this circumstance, we were able to bring those together. Now, going forward, the question of will we achieve a 30% renewable, 25% of that by wind, I think, as Laura McCartan said, that is still a question that we have to deal with. Because ultimately, we'll have to judge the economics of future wind. Without the production tax credits, we frankly see that's going to be a struggle. And we actually started to communicate that to the Minnesota Commission in the last resource plan, that we said we're not sure exactly on those future additions if we can get to the level of wind economically that was required by the 25% RES. So I think that's still a question that we'll have to answer going forward. And we certainly understand that we have to walk this fine line and see if we can bring both of those ideas together in one project. And if we can't, then we need to deal with it. This project, we were able to do that.
There was a discussion about hedging against natural gas prices. Is wind the only way to hedge natural gas prices?
No. There are a number of ways to actually hedge natural gas prices. You can certainly do it with the financial contracts on the NYMEX. You can do it through a physical contract. But the NYMEX is very thinly traded once you get out after about four or five years. And so doing a long-term hedge through the NYMEX is somewhat difficult. Doing a hedge, a natural gas hedge, through a physical contract is even more difficult than that. From my experience, since I have experience in multiple states, we did do a 10-year agreement in Colorado. And I'll tell you, getting a 10-year agreement, natural gas agreement at fixed price is very difficult. Mm-hmm. because you either have to post such large security or you have to get the legislature to codify that a commission won't disallow it in a future proceeding. And so it sounds like it is easy to do a long-term hedge. It's not. The fact is, wind is one of the few instruments that we can actually hedge for 20 years, use to hedge natural gas for 20 years. So it is really an effective means of providing that stability that you can't get in the natural gas market.
Is coal a hedge against natural gas?
Coal is a hedge against, not, I wouldn't say against natural gas, because coal usually doesn't come in and displace. Now, if it's a new coal facility, which was brought up, then you could look at it as a future hedge against natural gas. But the problem with getting a new coal plant permitted right now with the new EPA requirements is very, very difficult. I mean, you know, under the current rules, it's almost impossible. So, again, if you're looking at the viability of hedging, wind is one of the few instruments that we can actually use for long-term hedge.
One moment, Your Honor. I have no further questions.
Ms. Jeffco-Taco, any questions for this witness?
I do have a couple of questions. Thinking back to your summary, your introductory summary, where you were talking about need is not the question to look at, but the competing price in the market is the question to look at. Are you basically saying that need is an irrelevant concept in the since we've moved to the concept of the market, is need an irrelevant concept in your mind?
Not because we've moved to the market. Need is tied to a reliability standard more, which is that peak day, which is the capacity component of our resource planning. In resource planning, again, you deal with two worlds. One is the reliability world, that iron in the ground, that peak day. That is what I need. I need a plant or facility that will run on that peak day when it's the hottest day of the year. And that certainly is a need. And that's what MISO holds me to reserve margins. And so that is a true need. When you get to the energy side, that's the second world in resource planning. That's driven by dispatch and economics. And that's where you're not really talking about need as much as it which energy resource is most economic. Because, again, if you have that reliability covered, it is really then the question of what is the most economical resource to operate. And, again, for instance, when Sherco 3 was down this last year, did we need the energy from Sherco 3? No, it would have been nice to have it to compete in the market with, but we didn't need the energy because the energy came from the rest of the sources in the market. There are a number of options out there. So the need component is on reliability and on peak day, not for the rest of the year as much. It's really, those are the economics.
The second thing I was interested in, if we can discuss it without having to go into a closed session, was a little bit, so whatever you can provide, comparing any other North Dakota bids that had come in the RFP process, without getting too specific, because I don't think that I'm not asking to go mm-hmm. into the specifics enough to close the hearing, but if you can give us any generalities about the North Dakota projects that may have come in and why they weren't selected.
And a number of the North Dakota projects that came in weren't viable due to transmission issues and constraints and also the timing of getting them interconnected. When you look at the economics, there were a couple projects that would have been able to compete what it looked like in their bid price. But during the process of due diligence, which we obviously want to do to make sure the project can get completed successfully, we determined that those projects did not have the opportunity to get completed by the end of 2012 and get the production tax credit. Realizing the production tax credit is almost worth half of the cost of this wind, and therefore making sure that we get that is huge. We couldn't take the risk, nor could the developer take the risk, that the federal government wouldn't help pay for almost half of this wind. And so, although there were some bid projects that appeared to be economic, when you looked at the ability to successfully get them completed due to transmission, that wasn't going to happen. If you look at Prairie Rose versus the other projects that could be completed by the end of 2012, Prairie Rose was clearly more cost-effective than all of those resources.
That's all I have right now. Thanks.
Questions from the commissioners. Mr. Koch.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Hager, Curtis. The kind of bounce around a little bit here, but the first one, you had something in your testimony about you felt that, wind was a hedge for future carbon regulation. Tell me how you think that. I mean, are you a proponent of future carbon regulation? Or I mean, that's
no,
an interesting statement.
I'm not a proponent. But in my job as far as resource planner, I have to consider all of the potential risks. And certainly carbon is a potential risk. I'm not a proponent that it should be a risk. But in my job, I have to make sure that whatever portfolio I put together stands up under a number of different potentials in the future.
There's a potential that this commission would regulate carbon?
Of this commission? No, I believe if carbon is ever regulated, it's going to be at the federal level.
Okay, fair enough. Not that I agree with that, but I'll take the point.
I don't either. But
can you give me an update on the – I read through the testimony of the FERC tariff revisal. There's some negotiation taking on. Where are we at with that? It said September of 2012. We're past that time right now. Is that yours? Because that was in your testimony.
Yeah, Randy Oy, I mean, who's our transmission person, can give you a lot more detail on that. But my understanding is that MISO submitted the net zero interconnect tariff language, and that's been submitted, and I believe it's been accepted. But Randy could give you the specific information, but I believe with the settlement with the parties and then the tariff filing that that issue has been resolved.
Okay, and then this one, just kind of walk me through this. When you figure out price of, megawatt hours, if you will, when you come up with natural gas versus wind, let's just take natural gas versus wind, how do you calculate in the fact that natural gas is base load, wind is not? How does that factor into pricing?
In our dispatch models, we actually dispatch so we cover all of the hours, so we realize that wind is going to be blowing at certain times and natural gas would be available all of the time. And so when we actually do our dispatch, we allow those to compete all the time, every hour, okay?
So how does that work when if you need the capacity, if I see use that term right, the wind's not blowing? How does that factor into the model?
Again, when I look at the capacity, I'm looking at the reliability side, the capacity component side of my world. I make sure that I have enough capacity to meet my worst day, my peak day, right? Once I do that planning, then I'm really planning against different fuels. I'm looking at natural gas fuel that I can burn in that unit, or I can burn wind. And so I've already taken into account that I've built my system to handle the reliability side. Now it's just a matter of fuel trade-off. It's really the question of, you know, do I fuel up at this station or do I fuel up at that station? I'm already covered to make sure my system will operate. It's just a matter of what's the least cost fuel I use then.
After you've met all your needs.
After I've met my reliability and capacity needs.
So that goes back to, I think, what Lana was talking about is the, you have enough to meet your needs, this is above and beyond it for a certain period of time.
It's not that, because it's an energy. It's not a capacity.
What I'm getting at is that I'm more inclined to support a higher cost for a natural gas that will give me base load as 20 years changes the picture. So walk me through how natural gas is not a better alternative going forward, because you can have it there no matter when you need it. That's a better question.
Sure. From an operational standpoint, there is some benefit because, again, it's something you get. The question is
Is that benefit figured in all the money?
It is. And the question then becomes, what is the cost of that fuel going forward? Again, if you look at history, a lot of people were concerned about natural gas prices when they were at $12. Now they're at $4. In the future, they're going to be something else. We're going to have plenty of natural gas on this system. I guarantee you, when we look in the future, it is going to be
natural gas in North Dakota?
we're looking at that. We're honestly looking at that to see, and certainly we're not there today, but we are certainly looking at that.
You talked about transmission. There's one more witness coming to talk about transmission planning.
Yes.
Because I want to ask just the prep of it. Some of your, you said that one of the reasons that North Dakota alternatives maybe dropped out was the transmission congestion or constraint. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kevin. And we're not all in the MISO market. Well, Minnesota's not all in the MISO market, I don't think. Are they? I don't think the whole state is. So some of the, that's a part, I guess, for future witness to tee up.
Randy can.
That was it. Thank you.
Mr. Kramer.
Quick question here about what value do you give wind in your reliability models?
If it's a, again, under an NZI, net zero interconnect, sure, sure. We wouldn't give it any value at that time until it's converted to a traditional resource. At a traditional resource, we give it 12% nameplate value. So we take the nameplate, 200 megawatts, times 12%, 24 megawatts is the capacity value we'd give it.
Very good. I thought it was something like that, but mm-hmm. Thank you for clarifying it. One of the things I struggle with as I listen to all of this is that, and I appreciate your statement that it's that there's some art to it because it's based on the assumptions that you use, and that's sort of the struggle I think I always have, because I always think smart people can sort of rationalize their decision before they, you know, after they've made the decision. And I'm not accusing you of that, don't get me wrong. But so I'm thinking about the Minnesota legislature and their mandate. Do you remember what year they passed their 25 by 2025 and then the 30 by 30 for XL? Do you remember offhand? Was it previous to 2008?
Laura, when we jeez. The 25% came up when we kind of bundled all the buckets together. And wasn't that in 2007?
We could find it pretty quickly. Yeah.
Okay, here's what...
It was right around
okay,
there.
Okay, here's the point of my question. Because now you're struggling with this expiration date of 2012, December 31st mm-hmm. of this year, for the renewable. And clearly you've made the case that wind is not economically viable without the government paying for about half. And yet, prior to 2008, every year this uncertainty existed. And within this uncertainty, I believe the Minnesota legislature created the mandate. What role does the cost play in this policy? In other words, if the production tax credit expires. Mm-hmm. And not every utility has met the Minnesota mandate prior to the expiration of that mandate, or of that expiration. Does Minnesota withdraw its mandate? Are they going to change the mandate, or does cost even, or is this really about clean energy? Do you know what I'm saying? What's going to change in Minnesota on January 1st?
And again, I think we actually foreshadowed that in the 2010 resource plan. Cost does matter. It matters significantly. If you go talk to the chamber over in Minneapolis, they're very concerned about cost. We're very concerned about cost. We actually started to foreshadow in the resource plan that if we cannot find cost-effective wind, we will then have to review the assumptions that we can get to a 25% RES on wind. And I think that's something, again, that's one of those struggles that we'll have coming up. Exactly how do we deal with policymakers in Minnesota if that resource is not shown to be cost-effective going forward? And again, under what assumptions, that'll be debated. Mm-hmm. We have not really had to cross that line yet.
Sure.
Now, that's why with this project and our other projects, we've actually been able to stay on the side of economic. But that is going to be a debate coming up.
But if it's and maybe I don't understand the RES well enough. If it's a mandate, it's a mandate, isn't it?
Actually, it has off-ramps for economic consideration.
Okay. That's what I was going to say.
It does.
Okay. So now, speaking of uncertainty, we talk about all these assumptions related to gas. There's always going to be plenty of it. I mean, I've sat in the boardroom many times at the American Gas Association. We expect $6 gas for 1,000 years and all these things. And yet, a single policy by an administration to outlaw fracking Wouldn't that change everything? And isn't that a real possibility?
I can't say if it's going to be real. Certainly it's been discussed, and yes, it would dramatically change the gas picture of the United States. If you look at where we were before the explosion in fracking,
yes,
and at the shales,
yes,
this country could not sustain over about 51 BCF a day of production.
Right.
Within a matter of 2 to 3 years, production increased to almost 56 BCF a day. You could say almost overnight. That's why prices fell from $12 down to where they are today. A moratorium on fracking, even for a short period of time, would devastate the industry, and you would see very expensive gas prices. So, in answer, yes. Wherever this country is going to follow, wherever fracking decisions go.
Yeah. And I guess my point, and this is why this is your job, and you have to consider lots of things, but which certainties to accept and which trends to assume, I think it is as much, I guess, art as science, and I don't know if that's a fair statement, but I appreciate at least your acknowledgement that there's some art to it, and the assumptions you use do matter. I just don't know if what we can assume at all anymore, given the complexities of the diversity of cultures in our country.
Well, and the way that I look at things and the way the company looks at things when it comes to resource planning, when we come up with a natural gas forecast, we actually use four sources,
mm-hmm,
three professional agencies, PIRA, CIRA, Wood Mackenzie, and then the market.
Mm-hmm.
So we take into account the current market expectations and the other three. We blend them together equally, and we come up with a weighted four-source blend going forward. That gives us some comfort that at least if one agency is way out of whack or something that's going on, it'll get blended down and it'll take into account kind of a wide spectrum of expected costs. I use that forecast, and the only thing I can use is what it says at the time I'm making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the only reasonable approach I can bring to bear in resource planning, because I know I can never predict natural gas prices myself. If I did, I certainly wouldn't be in this chair.
Yeah.
I'd be in a beautiful beach right now and not worrying about rain. And the fact is, we attempt to make it a robust enough forecast so that we think we're in the right range as far as expected gas prices.
Sure. And I think sometimes in forecasting, the best teacher is history, and that's why it concerns me. But with that, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Fetch, any questions for Mr. Hager?
Well, I guess I don't really have questions, but I appreciate the questions of the other commissioners who have much more history in this area. All I can say is what you've given is some very good information for me, but for the life of me, I don't know how you sleep at night trying to figure out what what to think about for the future. It's a lot of unknowns. Thank you.
Mr. Kalk, anything?
Just one follow-up. When you were talking with Commissioner Kramer, it came up an off-ramp for cost on meeting Minnesota's mandate. I didn't know that. Could you explain more about that to me?
I don't have a lot of specifics about it, but I know that there is some economic consideration language in the mandate, and so that we have the ability to go back to the commission if we cannot find it to be economic.
Okay. Maybe for the attorneys, is there a future witness that could talk more about that? I'd just be curious to learn more about that.
No, Commissioner. I don't believe we have anybody that's really prepared for that. We can talk about that at a high level, but it may be more appropriate in a resource planning document.
Yeah. Okay.
It may be something we can address in the briefs.
Yes, I was going to suggest that we can follow up on that maybe on paper afterwards.
Because I don't know that it'll come into this decision in this case, but it's just definitely good background information. So, thank you.
Sure.
You never know what could come in.
Ms. Brahma, any follow-up for Mr. Hager?
Not at this time. As with all our witnesses, we do reserve the right to bring him back after the advocacy staff puts on their case, so to speak. But
okay.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Grumman.
Just one moment here.
Even if it's not placed in this evidence or something.
I think that at the conclusion of the questions for Mr. Hager, we'll take a short break.
Okay.
But I suspect some smart person will have it.
Well, I just have one. May I proceed, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please.
I just have one question. I'm kind of intrigued what Commissioner Kramer just indicated about how if there were legislation that would affect or that would free up fracking, how that would affect your resource planning. How about the greenhouse gas rule? How would that affect coal as far as your modeling for resource planning?
Certainly, if there was regulation on greenhouse gas emissions and they cap and trade or anything that imputed a cost on those emissions, we would then take that into account. Coal being the primary or the largest emitter of greenhouse gas, it would be hurt or impacted the most. Natural gas is halfway in between, wind very little, and so that would be kind of the range of spectrum depending upon what the regulation was at the time.
And I don't mean to limit you. I mean, in regard to coal, I mean, greenhouse gas, of course, is one major consideration for future resource planning. Are there any other rules or regulations in particular that are on your mind that you watch in particular for modeling coal in the future?
Not maybe specifically to coal. I mean, certainly any kind of SOx emissions, NOx emissions, any kind of dust or particulate emissions. So that could come into regional haze and so forth. Cooling, once through cooling, which is 316B, which is a regulation that's being contemplated to be final here, could impact both coal and combined cycle natural gas. So we watch a whole plethora of different EPA regulations, but also, again, the market dynamics between the various fuel and energy prices.
Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Nothing further, thank you.
Ms. Bromadie.
Nothing further.
Any of the commissioners? Mr. Hager, you're excused. We'll take about a 10-minute break right now. It's just after 10, so we'll say back at 10:12.
I
thought you were just keeping it. Now, six, that's an extra.
Yeah. For an advanced determination of prudence in the Geronimo Wynn matter. I think we've got all counsel and the commissioners back in the room. Just a reminder to get those trade secret agreements signed and back to Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle. Ms. Brahma, you may call your next witness.
If I may, Your Honor, before we do that, just address one housekeeping issue that came up during our break. As we left the testimony right before the break, there were some maybe some questions about the off-ramps for Minnesota's renewable energy standard. And I talked with counsel for advocacy staff as well as ALJ Ward. First of all, I think it's worth just noting that the off-ramps are contained in Minnesota statutes, Section 216B.1691, Subdivision 2B. The statute has several components to it, and our proposal is to brief the standard a little bit as part of our briefing for this hearing to provide a little bit more background for the commission for use in this or other proceedings. And we've already talked with ALJ Ward about briefing some issue of prudence and the standard for prudence, so we would propose to do this briefing at the same time. For purposes of this hearing, it may be helpful to the commission just to, as a brief overview, the subdivision 2B is a 2B, excuse me, is a modification or delay of standard is the title. It says that the commission shall modify or delay the implementation of a standard obligation, referring to the renewable energy standards, in whole or in part if the commission determines it is in the public interest to do so. And there are certain things the commission in Minnesota must consider when asked to modify or delay implementation of the standard, including the impact of implementing the standard on customers' utility costs, the effects of implementing the standard on the reliability of the electric system, technical advances or concerns, delays in acquiring sites, and other issues which we'll brief in more detail. But I thought that may be of some help to the commission before we continue.
Thank you very much for that.
All right. Thank you. Our next witness is Mr. Steve Wishart.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Wishart, I'm going to just admonish you, like I did the others, about the penalty for perjury, remind you that it's a Class C felony subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $5,000, or both may be imposed. Please raise your right hand, sir. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Wishart. First of all, would you mind stating and spelling your name and title for the record?
Sure. My name is Stephen Wishart. Stephen, S-T-E-V-E-N, Wishart, W-I-S-H-A-R-T. I am currently Director of Resource Planning and Bidding for Northern States Power.
Okay. Mr. Wishart, do you have in front of you there Exhibit 5 public and Exhibit 5 non-public?
I do.
And are these your direct testimony pre-filed and submitted in this proceeding?
They are.
Do you also have Exhibit 6 public?
I do.
And is that your rebuttal submitted in this proceeding?
Yes, it is.
And there is no non-public version of your rebuttal, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Could you go ahead and share your opening statement, please?
I will. as I mentioned, I am currently Director of Resource Planning and Bidding for Northern States Power. My background, I have a bachelor's degree in finance, a master's degree in economics, and I'm currently in the dissertation stage of my PhD in applied economics at the University of Minnesota. In my role, I currently oversee evaluations of all large power supply projects for the Northern States Power region. I provide value analysis for senior management, and I oversee our modeling software strategist. I provided direct and rebuttal testimony in this proceeding, focusing on our strategist modeling efforts around the Prairie Rose Purchase Power contract. There's that fly. In my initial testimony, I explained that strategist is a tool that we help assess the impact of new power supply projects on our customers by minimizing the overall present value of revenue requirements. Strategist is a well-respected industry tool. It's been used by, to my knowledge, in over 13 states in proceedings such as these. In our strategist modeling, we determined that the project had a virtual break-even impact on rates in our initial analysis. For my rebuttal, I re-examined the project in light of Mr. Hahn's direct testimony and other considerations that we've identified since my direct testimony was filed. In my rebuttal, I proposed updating the wind integration costs that we used in the original modeling based on more recent information available at the time. Two, I also adjusted the capacity credit that we had applied to the plant to ensure consistency with the NZI concept. As a result of these appropriate adjustments, it became clear that from a modeling perspective, the possible PVR results from the Prairie Rose were likely to be more favorable than I originally considered. I support Mr. Hager's testimony regarding the likely financial benefits of Prairie Rose and continue to believe that it's a prudent investment. Concludes my opening statement.
Mr. Wishart is available for questions.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I can never learn enough about strategists. So one thing in particular, because it's obviously very complex, so I'll probably try to dumb this down, I guess, maybe to my level. When you're modeling something like this, I mean, are you essentially, you're forcing wind in one and then having the results submitted and then essentially not submitting wind or this PPA and then having something else. Is that essentially, in a nutshell, what you've done?
That's correct.
Okay.
And then we compare the cost of the two to assess the impacts on customers.
Well, when you're not forcing wind, what is strategist picking?
Because the Prairie Rose and other wind projects have such a very small capacity credit, it's typically not building a new gas plant to fill that need. As Mr. Hager mentioned, wind is only currently receiving a 12% accreditation, and so the 200-megawatt project only represents 24 megawatts of accredited capacity. So there aren't any real new gas plants coming in to fill that need. What does happen is that the energy that Prairie Rose would have been providing is filled through the dispatch simulation. And that's replaced by a mixture of market energy, gas, and coal. And actually, I had an exhibit in my direct testimony that summarized what types of energy resources were being displaced by the Prairie Rose Wind Project.
Well, I just want to clarify one matter. You're talking about the 12% accredited capacity from MISO for this wind, but that's not 2012 and beyond. I mean, when does that 12% accredited capacity begin in your model?
In the model? In my updated rebuttal testimony, we are beginning that capacity credit in
2018. And Mr. Oyl, I'm sure will testify to this, but and that's the result of an assumed change in your interconnection with the grid from NZI to a traditional interconnect. Is that correct?
Correct. Mr. Oyl will speak more to that, but yes, that's the concept behind the start date of the capacity credit.
One moment, Your Honor. I have no further questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
We have no questions at this time. Thanks.
Commissioners. Commissioner Kauf.
I agree with Mr. Grumman on the complexity of strategists. So, but I guess the, just some thoughts. The so the model. I mean, is there anyone that would in the who are those that think this is not a good model out there? There must be somebody. Is this the industry standard where every investor-owned utility uses strategist?
Not every investor-owned utility uses strategist.
So what would be some other models that other companies would use?
There is competing products. There's a product called System Optimizer. Which is put out by the old Henwood company. They keep changing names, but it's the old Henwood company. It uses a similar algorithm to Strategist.
So would you expect much variability between systems that you use in output?
I do not. Okay. We have benchmarked the dispatch simulation in Strategist to a couple other models. ProSim is another in-house model that we use, and the dispatch simulations come very close.
Okay. Tell me how you – I noticed in your title, I guess, you're the also deal with demand-side management?
That was my first job when I started with the company, yes.
So how does demand-side management tie into the resource planning? When you look at, if you say wind is 12%, maybe you could shut something down for 12%. We give you that same 12%. How do you balance those two?
Oh, for demand-side management? I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, so if you need additional capacity, the instead of could you just shut down some large energy users, you know, to shift the load. I mean, how do you balance that in these models to where do you go out and get more? I always use these terms incorrectly. When you go out and get more capacity, or do you just lower your demand?
Yeah, and actually, it's kind of a two-step process. And when we look at the demand side management, they'll do an economic study of the region, seeing what types of energy conservation opportunities are out there and at what cost, and they'll know the cost of our capacity. They'll know that a typical peaker is going to cost $7 per kW month, and typical system energy is in the $30 to $40 range. So they'll have those metrics, and they'll be able to say, well, if I can retrofit this warehouse with more efficient lighting, does that pass a cost-benefit ratio test based on the cost of avoided capacity and energy from other resources? So they'll do that analysis and determine their DSM targets, their demand-side management targets. And at the beginning of our resource planning process, we'll include that in our load forecast. So we'll say load would have been growing at 1%, but our DSM group has identified these cost-effective demand-side management programs, so maybe load's only going to grow at 0.8.
Okay, so that's done long before you put it into the model.
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense. I think that was all I had. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Mr. Kramer.
No questions.
Mr. Fetch.
No questions. Thank you.
Ms. Brahma?
Nothing further.
Mr. Grumman?
No follow-up, Your Honor.
Nothing for me. Thanks.
Okay. That was quick and easy.
It's hard to get a pay raise if you don't stay in the stand long.
It just really is very interesting.
At this point, we'd call Mr. Oy.
Mr. Roy, again, the same admonition about perjury. I think you've heard it three times now. So having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Roy, could you state and spell your full name and give your title for the record, please?
May I stop you there just for 1 minute? The exhibits that I got for Mr. Wishart, I got two copies of his direct testimony, but I did not get rebuttal.
I'll ask Mr. Simpson to.
There's no non-public of his rebuttal. So.
I didn't get even a
my public. Apologies.
I got two copies of his public direct, but no rebuttal.
Okay.
And one of them's sort of got a purple sticker and one's kind of got a gray, so. Yeah, because we do want to make sure that mine are going to be the official record when. Okay, thanks.
Commissioners, are any of you missing a copy of Mr. Wishart's testimony? It should be public and non-public direct and only a public rebuttal. Okay, I think we're set. Mr. Oi, if you could state your name and spell it for the record and give your title as well, please.
My name is Randall L. Oi. First name is R-A-N-D-A-L-L, middle initial L, last name O-Y-E. I'm a transmission analyst for NSB.
And Mr. Oi, you should have Exhibit 7 public and Exhibit 7 non-public there with you. Are those copies of your rebuttal testimony in this proceeding?
Yes, they are.
And you did not submit direct testimony, correct?
No, I did not.
Just noting for the record as well that Schedule 2 to Mr. Oi's rebuttal in the non-public version is on a disk. It's a very thick document, a lot of data in it. We don't intend to refer to it. So in the interest of saving paper, you should have a disk attached to the non-public version of his testimony. Mr. Oi, could you please provide your opening statement?
Yes, thank you. I provided rebuttal testimony in this proceeding. I have a Bachelor's of Science degree from North Dakota State University in electrical engineering and have worked for NSP both as a direct employee and as a consultant since 1990. I have worked as a transmission analyst for nearly 6 years and currently am the chair of the MISO Interconnection Process Task Force and former chair of the Midwest Reliability Organization Wind Generation Modeling Task Force. I provided testimony in this matter on several transmission-related issues. I believe we have reached an understanding with Commission staff on one of those issues regarding why we did not select a particular bid identified by Mr. Hahn in our 2010 wind request for proposal. As a result of that understanding, this opening statement is focused on the status of the net zero interconnection concept at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, and how Prairie Rose works as a net zero project. FERC has approved the concept of net zero, but ordered that MISO add additional tariff provisions to ensure that net zero is administered in a transparent and non-discriminatory manner. Following 6 months of development and stakeholder discussions, MISO completed the additional net zero procedures and submitted them to FERC at the end of September. It is my opinion that the revised procedures accomplish the FERC requirements that the net zero process be fair and transparent as possible. FERC is expected to rule on the filing before the end of November 2012. Separately, FERC has addressed the Prairie Rose Generator Interconnection Agreement, or GIA, in two other proceedings. FERC has accepted the GIA for filing, subject to the additional MISO tariff procedures I just mentioned. In addition, FERC staff and the ALJ have recommended acceptance of a resolution of all claims with respect to Prairie Rose use of the net zero concept. The agreement FERC is considering explicitly provides that there was no undue discrimination in the selection of the Prairie Rose project. As a result of these proceedings, questions regarding the general concept of net zero service and its specific application to Prairie Rose are being addressed in the FERC jurisdiction. My rebuttal testimony also addressed Mr. Hahn's suggestion that net zero implementation might mean there are times when Prairie Rose and Anson could not deliver energy simultaneously to the grid. While it is correct that the nature of net zero creates this possibility, the amount of time and the number of megawatt hours in which this may occur is quite small. This is because peaking generation plant operation does not normally overlap with high wind generation conditions. This was illustrated in the study discussed in my rebuttal testimony that compared historical Angus Anson operation with our Fenton wind farm. That's the disc that is included in the non-public. In addition, the allowed interconnection capacity being assigned to the Prairie Rose Wind and the Angus Anson generating facility of 392 megawatts is enough to accommodate the full output of Prairie Rose along with Anson Unit 4, which is our newest and most efficient gas peaking facility. Lastly, I agree with Mr. Hager that if the Prairie Rose project is converted to a conventional interconnection in the future, it seems reasonable to conclude that the cost associated with such a transition would likely not be significant given the current transmission expansion plans in the Midwest. This concludes my testimony.
Mr. Oy is available for questions.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you. I understand some of this is in the record, but maybe it's just for the benefit of all. We'll do some reiteration. Before, it was just testified that from a modeling standpoint, there was going to be a MISO credited capacity beginning 2016. Why 2016?
I think he said 2018.
Okay. Why 2018 then?
MISO is in the process of the region. There's a number of major transmission lines being built. The CapEx lines, the one from Fargo to the Twin Cities. There's one from southwest Minnesota to the Twin Cities. And in addition to those, there's something there called multi-value projects, which is, you know, again, a number of 345 lines. Those connect Ellendale here in North Dakota to the Brookings. And then there's also a number that connect parts of Iowa and near Anson to the rest of MISO. The thinking is it's going to create a lot of transmission capacity. It's going to create it in the areas around Prairie Rose, and that should open up transmission to allow them to get a traditional interconnection.
From an engineering standpoint, the Prairie Wind project is fairly proximate to Angus Anson, is that correct?
Yes.
How many miles approximately of transmission line are there between Angus Anson and the Prairie Rose Wind?
It's around 25, I believe.
And that transmission line, is that being paid for by Prairie Wind, or is that something that NSP has purchased?
It's Prairie Rose is building it. It's basically a collector line. It comes into the interconnection point at where Anson is interconnected.
Now, you had mentioned that you currently have a FERC filing for approval of NZI, specifically, I believe, Attachment X to the tariff. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, is there a discrimination finding as part of whether or not that's going to be approved or not approved?
I'm not sure what you mean.
What's all included with FERC approving this NZI tariff? What are some of the findings that they're going to have to determine?
They approved it conditional. I'll back up a little bit. MISO put together, you know, the Attachment X is generation interconnection procedures. We submitted Q reform a year, you know, I think, I don't remember the dates, but November 11, I think, that changed the queue and added net zero. FERC ruled on it that they agreed with the concept. They thought it was a good addition to the system allowing additional options for interconnection. But they said MISO needed to change their tariff to make sure it's non-discriminatory and visible. And so what is happening, or what happened, FERC gave us 180 days, the IPTF commission with task force with MISO, 180 days to rewrite the tariff to make it fair and transparent. And MISO just finished that in the end of September. So what happens now is FERC will rule, you know, usually within 60 days on the MISO filing.
How has Prairie Wind been benefited by this NZI approach?
How has it benefited?
Mm-hmm.
By utilizing the existing transmission of Anson, we're sharing existing transmission. So it provided a benefit that, you know, it's cheaper. You know, they're using an existing transmission. I shouldn't say using, sharing. So it should have drove the cost down of the project. Plus, it allowed them to interconnect a little quicker.
Be true to assume with your RFP, specifically since it was focused upon wind and the NZI component, which of course was given to all, to anyone who wants to bid, wouldn't it be true that really those entities that are most going to benefit from NZI are going to be proximately located to a CT peaking unit? Wouldn't that be correct?
Correct.
One of the questions that I have is that going back to the benefit by Prairie Rose Wind, was that realized in this contract price? If you could please explain to us. I know it was in the record.
You know, I'm transmission. Um, I You know, I really can't speak to that.
Okay.
Our witness, Mr. Hager, does discuss that.
Okay, very good. Well, one question that I have is that now that if NZI is approved, certainly it's going to be utilized by Prairie Rose Wind, but my question is if you go to a traditional interconnect connect at 2016, if some other entity were wanting to use that NZI, since it's already been used once and it's been approved by FERC, you as a company would actually have to allow them to interconnect in that approach. Wouldn't that be correct?
Are you asking if Prairie Rose abandons that NZI connection?
Correct.
The way the tariff language is written, and NSP has the option, but they're not going to be obligated. It's the FERC, you know, it's they've chosen, you know, they allow the existing generator to choose to do it or not to do it. The only thing they said is you have to do, if you choose to do it, you have to be open and non-discriminatory.
So, I mean, really it's the case that since this has been done, if anyone else in the future wants to use this NZI interconnection, you would have to offer it to them. That'd be correct.
No.
How could you refuse it? I guess that's my question.
Because the FERC, it's optional. FERC has made this. It's not mandatory that an existing generator do a net zero. It's optional for a net zero to do, or excuse me, an existing generator to do a net zero.
Okay. One moment, Your Honor. Well, I guess, again, for the benefits of the record, if you could please explain if there is that changeover from NZI to traditional interconnect from an engineering standpoint, what's all involved in that scenario?
Prairie Rose would have to request a new generator interconnection. They'd have to submit a new generator interconnection request with MISO. MISO, they would pay deposits and study fees, and MISO would process it in their normal procedure. And MISO runs a system impact study first, and that identifies any upgrades. Following that, then they run a facility study, which calculates the cost of those upgrades. The next step is they enter a generation interconnection agreement. So Prairie Rose would have to follow that process. If there were transmission upgrades, they would have to pay those upgrades. And that's a process.
Do you envision if the MVP projects do come to fruition, a quick process, both from an engineering and a cost standpoint?
The process now with the revised Q reform, they're saying a year. So you should be able to go from your interconnection request to an executive executed generation interconnection agreement in a year. That process is pretty quick. The transmission needs, it's dependent. MVPs are scheduled for the 18-19 time frame today. That could slip. That could, be improved on. So, they're kind of the mercy of that. And if any upgrades were identified, they would need to pay for those, and that'll add time. At this time, as I said in my testimony, it's uncertain, that there'll be we don't know if there's going to be upgrades that'll be found in the studies, because everything's fluid. There might be a lot of interconnections that come into the queue before Prairie Rose. So it's kind of a function of timing. Based on their location and the robust system at Sioux Falls where they interconnect, it seems reasonable that there won't be a lot of additional stuff beyond the MVPs.
Under the contingency that, as you indicated, if it does, there is a change from NZI interconnection to traditional connect, who pays those costs?
Prairie Rose would.
Percentage.
Or the interconnection customer, whoever requests the interconnection.
Anything else? No further questions.
Ms. Jeff Kotsako.
No questions. Ours have been answered. Thanks.
Questions from the commissioners.
Just a couple of them. I think Mr. Grumman did a very good job of getting the questions out there, a lot of them that I had. The follow-up of, I think it was Mr. Hager's testimony, that the some of the potential options for a purchase power agreement or getting a wind farm in North Dakota just didn't work because the transmission lines weren't there. Is that correct?
That's one of two reasons, yeah, two of the main reasons.
Okay, so tell me this. So tell me how a customer, and if the power can't flow out of the state, how can the power flow into the state to meet Xcel's customers' and Minot's needs?
We have agreements with different utilities to provide that.
So could you also get similar type of agreements to move the power out of the state?
Yes.
So it could have been done then.
Well, the question is what cost.
Was that studied then, the cost? So
yes. Just to back up, the serving our load, NSP was a member of a MAP, Midwest Area Planning Pool, right, along with Minn Kota, Basin, WAPA, Otter Tail. And this is before I was real involved, but we had agreements with those companies to serve. You know, we serve some of their load, they serve some of ours over transmission. So we had shared agreements. Not all of those companies joined MISO. Otter Tail did, MDU did, NSP. But so there's, you know, the interconnection issue is you know, the way it works now is if you're going to interconnect and use their system, you have to pay them for it because they're not part of MISO. If they were part of MISO, it's all together. They get, you know, the funding is you know, I'm not familiar with how it works.
I follow most, not to your level, yeah, but the MISO.
So but to answer your question is we, to do it, we would have had to pay an additional. And we calculate it's somewhere around $10 a megawatt hour more to utilize a non-MISO's facilities to get our energy.
So if that's the case, then even though if this was somehow approved, the cost would go over all North Dakota customers, the North Dakota customers in the western edge of the state would not be benefiting from this by any of the energy created?
I'm not sure.
It doesn't work that way?
Well, I don't. Please, can you elaborate on your question?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out how a resource way in the eastern, not the eastern edge, farther east, is going to benefit customers in the western edge of the MISO region and where the North Dakota is, where we are, how this benefits them when the energy can't be moved to that level because of all these constraints.
I guess it's a function of which way is, you know, where do you need the energy? You know, do you need historically the energy from North Dakota flowed into Minnesota? You know, it flows west to east. With loads growing in North Dakota, you know, the energy might not flow as much in that direction.
Sure.
So.
I think that was it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Kramer.
Yeah. Geronimo, this project is part of we're in the vicinity of the Buffalo Ridge. Is that correct?
Yes.
The original transmission lines that were built for the first projects at Buffalo Ridge, let's go back. The original projects that started Buffalo Ridge, were they not built there in Minnesota as a part of the Minnesota mandate to build wind in the state of Minnesota? And would those transmission lines have been built had that mandate not been in place in the first place?
I believe they were built as part of that mandate.
So really now, all the benefits that we sort of supposedly realize, transmission and otherwise, out of that, really come from the original mandate that the first farm be built in Minnesota, because but for that mandate, perhaps the first farm would have been built somewhere else. Is that fair?
Buffalo Ridge was the best, you know, wind resource. I this was a little before my time, but the company chose that area to develop because it had the best wind resource in the state.
In the state, yeah.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the region, perhaps.
Some of the best in the region, but
sure. Yeah. With regard to, and maybe I should have asked this in the context of economics rather than transmission, but in the last 8 years or so, nearly 1,500 megawatts of wind capacity have been built in North Dakota by various entities, purchased by various entities, some by vertically integrated utilities, others by, you know, merchants with contracts. How does all that work if Xcel, who's a big player in energy in the region and has transmission lines and comes to us for prudence of other ones and citing. And how is it they can't do it? How are all these other people just dumb, or how do they get it done?
My understanding is a high percentage of that was built by non-MISO utilities. Mm-hmm. The MISO utilities that have built some had deliverability to their loads.
Sure.
So it's very difficult. It adds, you know, 10, you know, our calculation is $10 per megawatt hour if they're not connected to MISO. That's the big thing. I don't think a lot of that's purchased by MISO. And if it is MISO, they have, you know, like a DC line to deliver it to their
home. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it seems like a DC line might have a lot of capacity on it into Minnesota for others. But at any rate, I have nothing further. Thanks.
Welcome. Mr. Fetch?
Nothing. Thank you.
Council?
Your Honor, if I could just say one quick one. And I know you may not know this, but you probably know MISO better than I do. What does Great River Energy belong to? Are they in a power pool?
They're in MISO.
They are MISO. Yeah. So, and what is Minn Kota Power? Are they also part of MISO? Or are they?
No, Minn Kota is not.
Does Minn Kota belong in a power pool?
They were in MAP, but I'm a little familiar, but you know they participate somehow in the MISO. But they are not a MISO.
But Great River Energy is in MISO.
Great River Energy is, yes.
It just, that was kind of my earlier point. I think Commissioner Kramer followed up on it a little better than maybe I did in the beginning, was that Great River Energy's got a big footprint in North Dakota. And it just seems like a transmission diagram could have been put together to move power from the center part of North Dakota into the Minnesota. But you're saying that no.
Well,
the cost.
There are lines. There's not a significant number of lines. MISO has built, you know, and is building a lot to the Fargo area, you know, and you know, as with the MVPs to Ellendale. We've looked at a lot of different locations in North Dakota for wind, and there's a lot of times one line that runs, one MISO line that runs from, you know, Ellendale to Bismarck, just one little, you know, not little, but a 230 line. There's MISO lines all over there, but a lot of times they're islands. They're not contiguous. They don't go all the way from North Dakota continuously to MISO. So there's not a lot of MISO infrastructure in North Dakota. And that has impacted. The other issue with some of the projects, they're really the way the studies are done and you know the way things are done. There's not a lot of outlet today available out of North Dakota to sink into Minnesota.
So should Xcel Energy have a line of their own running from somewhere in Fargo or Grand Forks to Minot to meet Minot future needs for transmission?
That's not a question I can answer. We have arrangements to serve our loads with different utilities that's been, you know, worked and has seemed adequate, but I'm probably not the right one to.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks,
Your Honor.
Anything further, Council?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffers?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. You may step down.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I think we're going to have maybe a quick 5-minute break. Would that be possible? I'd like to talk to Mr. Lean a little bit, maybe come back to that witness right away.
Sure. We'll take about a 5-minute break.
Thank you.
Back at 11.
It was a little dark. Yeah.
Thank you.
parents.
First and only so far.
We just did our first. We got our second and only.
Oh, my.
That's exciting.
That is exciting.
Question. Being, I guess, a member of the public, if I sign the convention, are we my overseers?
No.
Okay.
No. You might want to talk to council.
Good morning.
How are you?
You had a question for me, I guess, about when the commission.
You want to do that?
It really is what it's more of their schedule than ours.
Yeah.
Our commissioners won't be able to hear you.
That's true. I guess my preference, because I'm going to be involved with this session, would be to try and do it before the end of the year. But I would have to, if you want to check the job list, I guess they're not going to start that project until April. Wasn't that what it said?
Yeah.
So, I could possibly do it in March, but then it might be moving target as far as you do. Whereas, if they said something for December, I could do it. So if it works for you, and if you want to check with John Morris and his council, if it works for them, would you be doing it? Let's see, that one was where it's in the rural areas.
It would be.
Is it Pennant County?
Probably was.
Yeah, which could be complicated. But yeah, you guys would be very collaborative. If you want to just give John Morris a call and see. If he wants to do it after the first of the year, then January, February.
Okay. Usually he says whenever you...
Okay. Well, then tell him I'd like to do it in December.
Okay.
Yeah, November or December. That's for me. Okay.
November would be... Oh, we got to get the 20 days, though.
Then we get Thanksgiving. It'd have to be either the last week of November or... More likely to something. Crawling up.
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Yeah.
So did you guys miss a storm that came through? Like northern Minnesota, you got about 14 inches. Did you guys get any snow?
Yeah, about 2 weeks ago.
We didn't get that.
No, we got a little dusting.
Okay.
But up in Grand Forks, they got some snow.
Yeah.
I think mine I've got 3-4 inches.
Yeah. I'm ready for you.
Yeah.
No, we had the lower moon, the horizontal wind.
Yeah.
Horizontal rain the other day.
It seems like it's changed a little, but when my kids were little, Halloween always seemed to be the day that the weather turned bad.
Yeah.
Either the day before or right on Halloween day, it would just go from nice fog to really nice. Right. Yeah. But it seems like it's later than the last few years. I don't know if that's global warming.
Well, it seems like we get this touch of winter earlier. Like, we've had some in the 5th inch.
Yeah. We'll get snow.
Yeah.
And then
it goes good a little bit. But it seems like when I was younger, too, like when our kids were younger, Halloween was the day. So you never knew what you were going to
do. They say the average first frost is September 15th.
All right. Okay.
Last year, it was September 15th. The weatherman. At 10 o'clock, I said it was going to freeze that night. I was out there picking all the tomatoes, and it did.
Yeah.
But then it warmed up, and it didn't freeze again. So.
Yeah, well, it's just an anomaly. Last winter,
Yeah, now this year, toward the end of
the problem comes in.
Okay, it's about 11:05. We're back on the record on the hearing on case number PU-12-59. Got Mr. Oy on the stand. Does anybody have any additional questions for Mr. Oy? Commissioner Calk.
Just one question. If you could work out a project to where you interconnect with Otter Tail in North Dakota, there would be no interconnection. The $10 you're talking about wouldn't apply.
Correct.
Would that be the same if you could work it with Great River Energy?
Correct. Yes, assuming that there's transmission, you know, the interconnection project has the transmission.
And same thing with MDU. If you could work out a project with MDU, you would
correct.
Not have to.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That was all I had, Your Honor.
Any other questions for Mr. Roy? Counsel? Go ahead, Ms. Brahma.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Oi, we've passed out in the hearing room here a document marked as Exhibit 11, non-public, and have stipulated with counsel as to the admission of this document, but maybe you could identify what it is before we go ahead and talk about it, at least on a conceptual level, understanding some of the detail is protected.
This is a map of MISO region, the western area, that we had a consultant put together. The highlighted lines are these planned MVP lines, the MVP and the CapEx line. So these are all new lines that are being planned, and these have been discussed about going in. And the reason we wanted to show this is just to show that there's significant infrastructure being built into North Dakota that's going to facilitate, expansion of, generation up there.
So when you talk about the limited transmission available now, how might that change in the future?
Well, these lines create, they're 345 kV lines. There's essentially two of them, two new ones coming out of North Dakota. I should clarify, I'm a transmission analyst, but I'm on the generation side, the energy market side. I'm not a transmission planner. The groups were separated, a few years ago, so I don't have planning knowledge. I have knowledge obtained through public means, but from my understanding, this will increase the outlet out of North Dakota, some thousand. The lines are rated, 1,000 megawatts and stuff, so it should create significant outlet out of North Dakota.
It might be helpful just for this group to clarify why the two groups are separated, transmission planning and transmission access.
This was a FERC 888, I believe, mm-hmm. And NSP, it was difficult. FERC 888, when it first came out, prevented the planning side from talking to the generation side. So the generation side formed a group of transmission experts, of which I am, like to think I'm one. So we could follow what was being done publicly with transmission, what was known publicly, so we could make decisions with our generation.
And I mentioned that in case there are further questions from the commissioners about transmission planning, we'd be happy to follow up with that. We don't have a transmission planning witness here with us today, but obviously we're happy to answer any questions that may come up. I did want to follow up, Mr. Oi, on you mentioned an additional $10 charge for the use of non-MISO transmission. Could you elaborate on what that means for any given project? How does that affect the cost of the project overall?
Well, the $10 is a pancake tariff. If you interconnect to a non-MISO utility, you're going to have to pay that utility a pancake rate to use their transmission system. And the $10 is, calculated based on, a capacity factor. I think we used 40%. That $10 would be on top of what we had to pay for the energy. So essentially, it's can be like 25%. It's an additional cost of 25% to the generation subject to the pancake tariff.
Thank you. I understand this exhibit may draw some more questions. We're happy to have others ask any questions they may have.
Mr. Grumman.
Excuse me. Before we proceed, did you say this exhibit was non-public?
It's non-public from a security or CEII.
Okay, I have in front of me public, it says. Oh, so do I have the correct exhibit?
I think so. Yes.
They made a pen change to non-public.
Okay.
You might just have the wrong sticker.
I have the wrong sticker.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to clarify.
Thank you, Commissioner Fetch.
And, Your Honor, I have no questions.
Jeff Gotsako is away. Commissioners? Okay, Mr. Jeff Kotzacker, do you have any questions?
No questions.
Okay. All right, you may step down, sir. Thank you. And again, let's bear in mind the caveat that that is a non-public document, the map. So. Okay, you may proceed, Ms. Brahma.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. We would call Carrie Clark at this time.
Ms. Clark, you've heard the perjury admonition, and again, I must remind you that perjury is a Class C felony. Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $5,000, or both may be imposed. Please raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Ms. Clark, could you please state and spell your whole name for the record in this proceeding, and if you could give your title as well, please.
Yes. My name is Carrie Chilcott-Clark. K-A-R-I, Chilcott is C-H-I-L-C-O-T-T, Clark, C-L-A-R-K, and I manage the renewable energy portfolio.
Okay. Do you have there with you copies of exhibits, Exhibit 8 public and Exhibit 8 non-public?
I do.
And are those your rebuttal testimony submitted in this proceeding?
They are.
And you did not have any direct testimony in this proceeding, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Could you please share your opening statement?
As I said, I am the Renewable Energy Portfolio Manager for Xcel Energy Services, the service company for the NSP entity that serves North Dakota. I have a bachelor's degree in mathematics and a master's degree in applied mathematics. I have been with Xcel Energy for over 14 years, and I have been responsible for managing the Renewable Energy Credit, or REC, portfolio for all of Xcel's jurisdictions since 2008. I submitted rebuttal testimony in this proceeding, focusing on the company's strategy to maximize REC value for our North Dakota customers. It is our view that selling all RECs as they are generated gives us no ability or opportunity to maximize the value of the North Dakota REC portfolio. By conducting market analysis, actively managing our REC portfolio, and looking for opportunities across the entire United States, we can utilize our expertise to earn more value from the marketplace. The REC market is still maturing. Liquidating all RECs immediately likely would not achieve the benefits of market maturation. Upon discussion with Commission advocacy staff, after our rebuttal testimony was submitted, we believe we have found a mutually agreeable future course of action concerning the REC issue. Xcel Energy will continue to manage its REC portfolio in the manner described in my testimony, working to achieve value for our North Dakota customers. At the same time, we will provide greater transparency to this commission by including monthly indicative REC pricing and information about any REC sales we made in the prior year in our annual North Dakota REO filing. This will enable the commission to track general REC pricing trends in the marketplace, as well as the details of any sale we actually make. We hope this is satisfactory. This concludes my opening statement.
And Ms. Clark is available for further questions.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you. Ms. Clark, do you have access to Exhibit 4? Thank you. Could you refer...
This is 3.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. If you could refer to the very back of that document, there is a schedule... Specifically, Schedule 1?
Yes, I see it.
Okay. Are you familiar with this schedule?
Yes.
Okay. I'm looking at these ever-increasing prices of $1.29.
Excuse me. I believe this is a non-public schedule.
Oh.
If we're going to be discussing that.
So it's interesting because I had wondered about that. I have the public version. And I have the schedule in here, but so maybe...
Is there any way we can just treat that as non-public?
Okay, let's...
Excuse me. Before we continue, we would clear the room of people that have not signed the form.
Okay.
I'm familiar with the protocol. I'd like to just discuss internally here whether or not we want to continue with these questions.
Okay.
So.
Before we get into the specifics of it, let's sort out... I also have an exhibit for public... That does have attached to it at the back a table. Is that the table you're referring to, Mr. Grumman?
It is, Your Honor. So maybe the company wants to react.
maybe if we could confer for just a minute with our witnesses and see.
One of the things we need to also consider is, was this pre-filed? Is this going to be already filed?
Yeah. Questions.
Yep.
I'll look in the docket.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
Is that public or non-public? I don't know.
Let's go on. Gary, do you want to?
On the record and for the benefit of anyone out there listening, we did make a determination that, in fact, the particular chart or table being referred to is a public document, not a non-public document.
Thank you. If I may proceed, Your Honor?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess essentially my question is, our current REC price is substantially lower than what is anticipated in this model as formalized in the schedule. If you could please explain.
Actually, the $1.29 REC price that's shown in 2013 is very similar to an RFP, not an RFP, a broker deal that we are looking at right now for 2013 wind. So I think these prices are right in line with what we're seeing in the market.
And it's increasing. If you could please explain for the record why it's increasing every year.
It's forward-looking. So as you sell farther into the future, there's a higher risk, and so those RECs are worth they have a slightly higher value.
So there is a risk component to that. It's not just pure inflation.
The risk is that those RECs will be entered into a transaction and they will never be created. So there is certainly a risk there.
Okay. Any further questions? One moment. I'll wait for Mr. Simpson.
Okay. We're just clarifying with Mr. Hager, to whose testimony this is attached. Now, I believe, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe actually this 1.9% inflation rate is what's imputed to these numbers.
After
2016, it's market price, and at 17, it's just a straight inflation.
Okay.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. From advocacy staff's understanding, you had just testified to a quote-unquote broker deal for the establishment of this $1.29. It's our understanding that's not currently within the record. And if our understanding is correct, could that be included into the record for consideration, assuming that essentially these prices are rolled into the least cost scenario for this project?
The broker deal that I'm talking about has not been executed. It's being routed internally through Excel. So it's not a completed transaction, but it is certainly showing us what the market prices available out there are if we have the relationships and we're diligent about looking for the higher prices.
Thank you. One moment, Your Honor. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
This is Jeff Kotsako.
We have no questions.
Commissioners?
Maybe a couple, Your Honor.
Chairman Cox.
Thank you, Kara, for your testimony. The walk me through, you said eight states, so that's all the XL states, I would presume, right? Of those eight, could you know off the top of your head which ones have renewable goals and which one have mandates?
Yes, they all have mandates except for North Dakota and South Dakota.
Okay, that's easy enough.
That's goals.
All right. You said one of your jobs is ensuring compliance with renewable portfolio standards and developing compliance plans, retirement plans. So So how what does that mean exactly? I mean, you develop a plan for each state?
Yes.
So what does your current plan for North Dakota include, your current plan?
The current plan for North Dakota is no RECs would be retired until 2015 when the renewable energy objective starts, and then we would start retiring RECs at that point in time, and we would retire the oldest RECs that we have in the portfolio for compliance with that objective.
Sure. Do you talk with other agencies in the state, such as Basin Electric, and compare at all what your plan, if you will, is compared to what their plan is, so the state is uniform, or is each one treated differently?
I have not had any discussions with other utilities. My hope is that there would be a workshop for all of the North Dakota utilities so we can get some guidance on how this will look as we get closer to 2015.
Okay, and then the MRETS board, are you part of that board in that discussion?
I am part of the subscriber group, and okay. I've chaired the subscriber group of the MRETS board in the past, and I also serve as the chairperson of the enhancement committee for MRETS. So we're working on improving the MRETS system.
Okay. Has the MRETS undergone some changes recently as to who manages them?
Yes.
Could you walk me through what those changes are?
Yes. MRETS originally was managed by the Wisconsin PSC. They took care of the oversight of MRETS. And the past year, year and a half, that was transitioned to form a nonprofit entity, MRETS Inc. It still has the MRETS board, but now they are the board of a nonprofit organization. And they are taking a more of a substantial role in the policy of MRETS.
To your knowledge, do all the states have members on this MRET board, all the eight that you talk about?
Not the eight Excel states, because only four or three of our states in NSP are in the MRETS system.
Okay.
But I do know that North Dakota PSC has a member on that board.
Yeah, but we had some discussion about that, whether that's appropriate going forward since it's changed scope, if you will. But
right. And I'm sorry, I misspoke. There's four states NSP serves that are on MRETS. Michigan is not.
Okay. Thank you. That was all I had. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Kramer?
I have no questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Fetch?
Thank you. No questions.
Follow-up.
No further questions, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
One follow-up, please. What is your plan for the South Dakota credits, if any? How is the company proposing to handle South Dakota credits?
The same plan as North Dakota for 2015. We'll start retiring RECs in 2015.
Thanks.
Anything further? Okay. You may step down. Ms. Brahma, where do we go from here?
At this point, we have offered all the witnesses we intended to initially. I think we would reserve the right to recall our witnesses after advocacy staff puts on their case, so to speak.
Okay, so you're ready to shift over to their presentation of their case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman, do you want to start now, or do you want to take a lunch break now and start afterwards?
Ask the commissioners what do you want to do.
Let's go eat. Come back.
Okay. We'll take a break now. try to have everybody back in the room by 12:15. Okay.